I'm intensely concerned about our current environmental situation. There are so many resources and tools and ways of thinking through our current moment, which is not just an environmental crisis, but in the words of Pasang Sherpa, who is a scholar at University of British Columbia, she said to me, it's also a crisis of imagination.
You're listening to Buddhist Studies Footnotes, and I'm Frances Garrett. Today I'm speaking with Devin Zuckerman. Devin has just completed her doctoral degree in Buddhist Studies at the University of Virginia. Her dissertation was entitled Earth, Water, Fire, Wind, and Space: Elemental Theory and Practice in the Development of the Great Perfection Heart Essence Tradition of Tibet. It's a study of how Buddhist traditions have developed complex philosophical, medical, astrological, and contemplative theories and practices around what are known as the primary elements, that is, earth, water, fire, wind, and space. Her research describes how human and more than human beings directly experience the elements. So, how we experience the earth's solidity, the fluidity of water, the heat of fire, and the movement and expansiveness of wind and space. In this conversation, we talk about how the elements are experienced both internally and externally. As Devin describes it, the elements are known internally as bodily tissues, fluids, metabolic and respiratory processes, and externally as material and meteorological phenomena in the environment. We also talk about Devin's use of ecological feminist depictions of embodiment, and about cosmological and ecological forms of religious experience, such as the supersensory ability to hear the voices of a more than human environment.
The elements, in fact, predate Buddhism in India. It's a shared cosmological system that exists in Hinduism. I think the earliest references to a framework of four or five elements is in the Rig Veda. So quite an old system for thinking through what the material world is made of. And it has different kinds of manifestations in Nyaya, Vaisheshika philosophy, Samkhya philosophy, yoga, Ayurveda, the tradition of Indian medicine. And consequently, because Buddhism is, originally a tradition that arises out of Indian culture, the five elements become a way in the Buddhist traditions to talk about the materiality of the surrounding environment and the materiality of our bodies, and very often the kind of material interconnections between the two. So you see the Buddha discusses mindfulness of the elements in the context of mindfulness of the body. In the Buddhist Nikayas, there's references to the five elements in the Prajnaparamita literature, in the Abhidharma traditions, which are the metaphysical traditions of Buddhism. The two most popular traditions that exist today, Northern Sarvastivada tradition associated with Vasubandhu, and the Southern tradition associated with the Theravada tradition. Both cases have very different and unique ways of talking about contemplative practice with the elements, how the elements form the foundations of the universe, their role in embryology, what happens to the elements at the time of death, and so on.
What does it mean to say that the elements exist in our body, but also in the natural environment or in the environment outside our body in terms of specific elements?
Yeah, my research is Tibetological primarily, but I have this real interest in the way that the elements are talked about in the Pali Suttas, the Nikaya literatures of the Theravada tradition. And so to give an example from the Sutta literature, the Buddha talks about the elements being both in the environment in terms of the matter that we encounter in the natural world, the rivers and oceans and the mountains and the literal examples of fire that we use to cook and that we use to heat our homes and so on. And then he also talks about these same elements manifesting internally in the body in terms of, in the case of earth, the flesh and bones of the body. In terms of water, it's the fluids of the body. In terms of fire, it's the sensations of heat and temperature in the body. And in terms of wind, it's this interoceptive experiences of movement, respiration being the key example. And so in those cases, the Buddha seems to be indicating that the elements form a medium that connects these outer worlds to the inner world, and also helps Buddhists who are training in mindfulness to regard dispassionately the elements of their internal body as part of their contemplative approach to working with attachment to the body. So that's one example from some early Buddhist texts.
How would an understanding of the elements in the body make me think more dispassionately about their workings?
The Satipatthana Sutta especially is interesting because it talks about how a monk should regard the elements of the body the way that a butcher regards cuts of meat, quite an intense metaphor, right? To say that when we can divide the parts of our body into these components of earth, water, fire, wind, and space, and we can also see that they represent a kind of matter that is non-different from the kinds of matter that we encounter and that we use to our advantage, right? That we manipulate and that we interact with in a kind of dispassionate way in the natural environment, that is theorized to help a person disregard the elements of the body as being somehow special or unique or elevated above the elements of the environment.
And is this what we mean by talking about the elemental body and the outer and inner elements, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking that. I mean, what's fascinating, I think part of what fascinates me about this example from the early Buddhist suttas is that it's so different from the references to the elemental body that I've encountered in my research, which is in a Tibetan tradition known as the Great Perfection or Dzogchen, a distinctive contemplative tradition reaching its most important developmental strides in Tibet, but with many contributions from Indian forebears. So in those contexts, there's this really kind of surprising use of the language of the elemental body, which is divergent with what we see in other elemental systems in the Buddhist world. There, the elemental body type is a information technology or a system that's used within one text in particular known as the Unimpeded Sound Tantra to map human diversity in terms of the elements. Indeed, I think these texts also acknowledge that our body is composed of elements, but it also theorizes that there's one particular element and one particular kind of elemental energy that is predominant in our human bodies. And that has consequences for our personalities, our likes and dislikes, the kinds of medical treatment we need to receive. So that's a really different example in which the elements are being used, you know, in a completely different way to map human difference rather than human sameness or homogeneity.
I like how you phrased that. So you're talking about traditions that describe people as being wind dominated or earth dominated, right? And so this is then linked, isn't it, to Ayurvedic traditions that also talk about a person's constitution as being related to their relationship to the elements or to warm and cold qualities. But then also Chinese medicine has similar ways of, as you say it, mapping human diversity.
There's a lot of influence from the Ayurvedic traditions. I mean, certainly there are references to a key characterizing feature of Ayurvedic medicine, the humoral system, which I think you sort of referred to. Influences from all those traditions you named are really present there and being integrated in distinctive ways that help to make sense of the unique philosophical interests of the Great Perfection tradition.
Before I ask you more about the Great Perfection tradition and how it works with the elements in this special way, could you say more about how the elements function as information technology or a relational media that connects human bodies and non-human environments? You also tie this to ecological feminist depictions of embodiment. And I wonder if you could give us an overview of some of those ideas.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that's my key interest. Another really interesting component of the Great Perfection or the Unimpeded Sound Tantra as a work of great perfection literature, this text's interest in the elements has to do with a set of contemplative practices that are called the yogas of the four sounds of the elements. And these practices, which involve listening to elemental sounds in nature in order to both create, in the very old tradition of Buddhist contemplation, right, to create transformations in the self that are liberating, emancipatory, and so on. So there's that component of it. But another component of it is that by listening to the sounds of elements in nature, again, listening to the sounds of water, let's say, so listening to the sound of rushing water or a waterfall, the practitioner is theorized to begin to hear the voices of more than human others, especially the voices of this really important female figuration in Indian and Tibetan Hinduism and Buddhism, known as the Dakini. I'm very fascinated by the dual goal of these traditions, which is both to, in the customary Buddhist way, to overcome ourselves in dynamic ways that entail emancipation and liberation, but also this idea of making intelligible a more than human world. These practices also intersect with what we talked about earlier about the elemental body type, because there's an understanding that the way that you do these practices needs to align with your internal body type in order to bring about these expected religious experiences. So there's a mapping of the practitioner's internal body with a more than human world. For instance, if you're a water body type, you should do the practice on water first, right, in order to actualize the goals of the practice. So that's one place where I see an interesting contribution to ecofeminist discourses, especially the work of Stacey Alimo on transcorporeality, Claire Colebrook and Astrida Nemenis also, this idea of weathering as a way of relating to the conditions of climate change, which have to do with mapping how climate change phenomena actually manifest within our bodies as a kind of experiential practice.
I love this idea of thinking about how climate change is manifesting in our bodies in this experiential way. Of course, we know it feels hot outside,
right,
maybe, but you're talking about something much more subtle than that. But then also working with these intentional practices to kind of realize this learning in a more transformational way.
Yeah, and Claire Colebrook's work is so fascinating. She's working from the perspective of feminist theory, and to see the ways that I find some of these theories and these practices operationalized in the Tibetan literature. The authors that I'm reading are not writing from a perspective of climate crisis. So what does it mean for me to be someone who can't unthink the climate catastrophe while I'm reading it? So these correspondences are very much a part of just being in an Anthropocene paradigm or being adjusted to a way of thinking that's based on Anthropocene knowledge. Is an interesting question that I'm holding in the research. Yeah.
I want to ask you to describe these practices of the elements, thinking about if I'm a water body person, mm-hmm. I do this contemplative practice on water, but it's not thinking about water. It's not going into the water. It's like listening to the sounds of the water, you're saying, and then it's making intelligible the more than human world. How is that imagined?
When you're doing these sensory practices, it's really a kind of multi-sensorial practice that engages the whole sensorium. Let's just say in terms of sound, you're listening to the sounds of water, and within the sounds of water, the voices of the Dakinis become perceptible. And they don't talk about specific utterances that you might hear, but they do talk about in the text feelings, like the Dakinis are regarding you, the Dakinis are laughing, the Dakinis are wrathfully speaking, right? So you're experiencing
their vibe.
Yeah, their vibe. Exactly. That's funny. There's a very sensory-based experience of connection with a more-than-human reality that, especially in the case of the Dakini, is like this really important religious figuration that you're encountering.
Are you listening to the sounds of the water because the Dakinis are what you want to hear? So are you really hearing the sound of the Dakini, or do you actually care about the sound of the water? And I'm wondering about that just because I'm thinking of the more than human world being mainly life-based. Is it sentience that you're listening for, or can you also be listening to and valuing, therefore, the non-sentient, which is a more than human world that goes beyond only life-based sentience, life-based forms? Can we appreciate, in other words, the sounds of the earth for itself in its non-life-based reality? Or are we just, or are we really looking for the animism, the animist nature of these environmental features?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the experience of the more than human world is a byproduct of the practice, which is designed to liberate, to actualize, in fact, the bodies of the Buddha, which gets into a complicated soteriological, metaphysical understanding of liberation in the context of Buddhism. So this experience of the more than human world in terms of this animate world of Dakinis, they talk about Dakinis and Yakshas and the beings that exist in all six realms, pretas, for instance, ghosts, the hell beings, all of these, and in fact, the inner lives of human beings also, the inner dialogues of human beings also become perceptible at some point in these practices. The practice itself is about harmonizing the inner elements with the outer elements in order to produce an experience of freedom. And only secondarily to that do these cosmological sounds naturally manifest as a result of it.
I guess it would be an interesting thing to ask a practitioner who does these practices what they think.
Yeah, it's hard to know based on the texts themselves. And the texts presume also the presence of someone who's experienced in the practices to describe the practices to you.
And it depends on what you're looking to know, because as you're saying, you're reading these texts from a perspective of climate crisis and your embeddedness in that kind of reality, whereas right. maybe authors of texts even 20 years ago wouldn't have been thinking along those lines. And so we do that. We can inhabit texts and ideas and practices from our own perspective. We can't do otherwise. Hmm. And so now I wonder if these practices for interested practitioners might be a way of kind of tuning into the value of non-life-based features of the natural world.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. And I think an important piece of it, again, has to do with this aligning of the inner bodily elements, the element in which you have a predominance connected to the element in the outer world. There's something about that that's described as being critically important to making these practices work. To borrow a phrase again from Stacey Limo, the transcorporeal interconnection between outer world and inner world, that does seem like it's critically important. Of course, we also have a biomedical perspective of what the human body is that also could potentially stand in the way of actualizing the goals of the practice that are based on this elemental way of knowing the world and knowing one's body. Yeah.
In your work, you point out how the discussion of the elements in the text, the tantric text that you have worked on a lot, occurs right at the end of a section on physiology of the body, and also then these embodied contemplative practices. And so I think that's what you're talking about, is why the elements, which we might think of as related to the external world, are really centrally part of our physiology. It's a way of describing our physiology.
Yeah, it's a way of describing our physiology and a way of making sense of why we seem to be affected by the external world. There are ways that biomedical epistemologies have made sense of the interactions between the inner world and the outer world. For example, communicable disease, right? That finds expression in these ways, in distinctly elemental ways based on elements as a way of knowing the world in these texts.
So a lot of people might think of contemplative practice as mainly practice of the mind, and often contemplative practice, at least in the Atlantic world, North America, Europe, is presented as kind of a cognitive practice or a practice of mind training. But you're really talking about embodied contemplative practices, which is less known about to many people here. Can you say more about how these embodied practices that focus on the elements, like the listening to the sounds, and thinking about your own natural relationship elementally with the external world, what is the larger context for embodied contemplative practice into which this fits, or how does this come to be in Buddhism?
So there's a long history within Buddhist traditions of embodied forms of contemplative practice. There are practices that are akin to contemporary North American and European awareness of yoga, like the Hatha yoga types of practices. There are practices that are used in the texts that I look at. One thing I'm becoming increasingly interested in is the use of like postural practices within these texts as a way of treating human illness, for instance, which begins to speak to your questions about embodiment as a contemplative paradigm. The idea that contemplation would be reduced to the mind, attentional practices of mind, would be laughable to some of these authors because it's such a small fraction of what is regarded as a contemplative life. And in fact, what is a contemplative life includes, like I said, postural yogas that treat illness in addition to liberating someone from samsara, the cycle of suffering. Practices that involve the use of mantras or the use of speech, not necessarily the body or the mind, but this dimension of the use of the voice as a way of engaging in contemplative practices, as well as a whole array of ritual practices, rituals for extending the life energies. What life is a great question, a huge question for me and the research I'm doing now. Practices in the tantric milieu have to do with internal visualizations, again, that sort of interoceptive sense, which is sensory and in a sense embodied, as well as being attentional. This distinction between mind and body is very much an Enlightenment era idealization of how to organize knowledge that doesn't exist in the text that we're looking at.
Those are so many great examples. And there's also walking meditation, which is an embodied practice. But then there's also a pilgrimage where you go to a place and you put your body in a certain place. You circle around a mountain or you prostrate many times before a sacred object. And so there's all of these movement practices that are central to the life of a Buddhist in many places in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
That are not about sitting in a chair and thinking, you know, about quieting your mind.
Right. And it's such a rich and diverse world of contemplation. It's a motivation for me to bring more popular attention to the diversity of contemplative practices that there are.
So maybe we could go back to the great perfection tradition that is the focus of your research. Can you describe that tradition a little bit and tell us why it's such an interesting tradition for someone who's interested in embodied contemplative practice?
The Great Perfection is an esoteric tradition of contemplation and Buddhist soteriology and the collection of scriptural texts and ideas and philosophies that as a tradition understands itself to have originated in India, but we could say hit its most important developmental strides in Tibet, within the Nyingma tradition and the Bun tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. What characterizes the Great Perfection is a critique of some of the normative conventions of late medieval Indian Tantra, which, according to the Great Perfection tradition, it's critical of Tantra's general emphasis on practices that involve forceful manipulation of the body's subtle energies in order to produce religious experiences and the complicated use of ritual and so on. What characterizes the Great Perfection is this critique of those practices, instead advocating for ideas like rest and relaxation and naturalness as a path to liberation. So that being said, there is a lot of embodied kinds of practices. I mean, the kinds of practices that I just described that involve working with the body's subtle materiality, subtle energies to create religious kinds of experiences, the use of postural kinds of yogas, the use of sensory practices that involve visualization techniques, producing interoceptive visions, as well as, I think, less popularly known, this repertoire of practices that I'm bringing attention to in my research that have to do with the elements and with the senses in particular as a path to liberation in the distinctive idiom of the Great Perfection. Tantric Buddhism, which originated in India and was continued and elaborated in Tibet and in the Himalayas, there's a lot of emphasis on the body, a lot of emphasis on the senses, a lot of use of rituals that necessarily entail the use of the body, the use of the voice, and so on. So it's really hard to say that the great perfection is distinctly interested in the body, but it does have its own take on the body and the importance of the body in the both cosmological and metaphysical understanding of what it means to be a human being.
You said a couple of things I want to follow up on. One is you talked about the materiality of the body and its energies. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, are the energies of the body material? And then you also talked about life and how you were so interested in this question of what life is. And I'm not sure if that ties into the other question, but maybe we could address some of these big concepts.
Yeah. I think originally part of the motivation for this interest in the elements is that I'm really interested in kinds of materiality that are hybrid. In Tantric Buddhism, there's an understanding of a subtle body of energies that have religious or spiritual resonance and that are also integral in religious experiences that we have. I began with an interest in this subtle body and became increasingly interested in the elements as a way of trying to make sense of what the subtle body is. So the energies that are being used in these practices, are they material or are they not? It's an outstanding question. It's a question that I'm still very interested in. Life itself as an idea also is present in some of the things I'm looking at now. There's a lot of words in the Tibetan Himalayan world presently and in the diverse textual and religious traditions that exist in the Himalayas to talk about this idea of life. There's this idea of sok, which is like your life impulse, right? There's this idea of te, which is the span of life. There's this fascinating idea of la in the Himalayas that's construed in multiple ways and in different, not just Himalayan Buddhist, but in other Himalayan cultures and communities to talk about a free floating life energy that can sometimes actually get loose of the body and be accidentally or purposefully transplanted. So this kind of hybridity really interests me. And the elements are just one component of a wider set of discourses about hybrid kinds of matter or material third spaces, which is really going to be the focus of my research going forward. Yeah.
That sounds fantastic. That sounds so interesting. And it really cuts at the core of some of the assumptions, metaphysical assumptions or ontological assumptions that we as non-Tibetan readers have when we encounter these texts. When we think we know what matter is or what substance is or what energy or life is, we have to really go to the ground and question all of these ideas. Otherwise, we run the risk of real misunderstanding.
Yeah, definitely. And there's also a chance potentially to rectify kinds of colonial narratives and idealized Enlightenment era thinking about the body and the mind and matter and spirit, right? A distinction that's really important within the European Enlightenment era way of thinking about philosophy in the material world.
Does this paradigm that you're working with, the elemental paradigm, help us think newly and helpfully in this climate crisis era about so-called nature?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a really important area of inquiry for me. To put it really simply, the ways that the elements subvert kind of normative nature culture binaries that are still operative in the wider world of academic humanities thought, but also in the world of Buddhist studies, despite the fact that there's a lot of materials that serve as a counterexample to that way of thinking about the division between nature and culture. We started this interview, I was talking a little bit about the Nikayas and this idea of the inner elements and the outer elements. Really interested in this distinction of inner and outer versus nature and culture, because they almost seem to be symmetrical ways of thinking, whereas the distinction between nature and culture becomes one of the distinction between the internal human experience and the external natural surrounding world. This inner outer elements paradigm subverts that idea by first distributing matter in terms of the inner matter of the body and the outer matter of the world, and then subverts it a second time by saying, actually, it's the same thing. What we're working with is the same material substrate. There's no difference between what we're made of and the constitutive setting that we're living and operating in.
I wonder if you would feel like sharing some aspect of your non-academic training that has brought you to think about these kinds of questions.
I'm intensely concerned about our current environmental situation, climate catastrophe or climate crisis. There are so many resources and tools and ways of thinking through our current moment, which is not just an environmental crisis, but in the words of Pasang Sherpa, who is a scholar at University of British Columbia, she said to me, it's also a crisis of imagination. Buddhist epistemologies, indigenous epistemologies, other ways of thinking through what we're experiencing now has immense value and gives me hope for the future. So I would say that's my personal motivation at the moment.
This episode of Buddhist Studies Footnotes was created, produced, and edited by me, Frances Garrett, with support from the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Toronto. This project aims to make Buddhist studies research freely available to students and the public.